When I was 18 years old, I was first introduced to spiritual teachings and, among other things, to the concept of reincarnation, which, of course, was very much more exotic all those years ago. Now it's still not commonly accepted in this part of the world, but nonetheless, we're a lot more aware of it. And it was such an interesting idea to me. I had no particular reason to think it was true. There was no context at all in my life for it. But nonetheless, it was such an intriguing and potentially satisfying answer to the enormous differences, to explain the enormous differences and inequities that surround us every single day. I was born into a somewhat intellectual family and given a certain number of opportunities at a young age. I don't ever actually remember learning to read because I just somehow always knew how to read. Everyone in my family was reading, and it was just sort of what we did. And so by the time I went to school, I was, you know, just all of the things I was supposed to learn there, I mostly already knew. And I could always attribute it to the way I was raised, but it was so much more likely once I started thinking in terms of reincarnation that you don't start with a blank slate. Not everybody starts at the same starting line, that the chapters, the experience of what appears to be one incarnation is simply a chapter in a much longer book. And in the middle of a story, you realize that a lot has already happened. And even if the chapter can stand alone because the adventures are sufficiently interesting and finish enough, nonetheless, if you think in terms of it starting earlier and going on longer, at least I found when it was introduced to me at that point, I started looking at life as if it were true. And it began to make so much more sense out of things than anything else that I had known, that gradually, without even knowing exactly what point it began to happen at, it just began to be the way I looked at things. And I remember years ago when I was teaching at Ananda's meditation retreat at that time, which was 6 miles up this dirt road, and I was giving some kind of a class, and it might even have been the class was reincarnation, but whatever it was, I was talking freely about it. And some man had just kind of hitchhiked up there and wandered into the class. I don't think he had any idea where he was, and he certainly didn't know why he was there. And afterwards, I gave him a ride back down to the main community area. And the distance between the meditation retreat and the main community is not only 6 miles, but it goes across this extremely barren, unpopulated area, which the landscape is decimated because they did hydraulic mining there 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and it's still just like a moonscape. So we're right in the middle of this most desolate area, and honestly, he sort of looked around to make sure no one was listening, and he said, "You really believe that stuff?" You know, like, nobody will know if you tell me the truth. And I essentially laughed and told him the story I was telling now. But I also had learned enough by that point to say to him, if it's not reality for you, it's not reality. I remember some man saying in a very sort of regal way, "Well, if you want to incarnate, that's fine, but I choose not to." I thought, "Ha, you think you have that much freedom?" But it didn't make any difference. It's what he wanted. But it's the way it is with all beliefs, or beliefs that become faith because of our experience. We just can understand what we can understand. And our reading today is talking about the reality behind things. Some people see a certain universe, and other people simply see another one. Because I'd read, of course, what the subject was today about everything being symbolic. When I came forward and saw these yellow roses here, which some of you can't see, they're a little small, let me hold them up. It's just like these roses were just saying, "Hello, I'm so glad I'm here." You know, there's so much just dynamic energy in those little flowers. And yet, you know, it just takes a certain attitude toward life to see it. Otherwise, people will just see flowers. And all along on the spiritual path, both with ourselves and especially with the people we deal with, we always have to realize that spiritual understanding cannot be forced. Swamiji writes in his new book, he's writing faster than we can read right now, which is a little bit tricky. The latest one he just published, Revelations, the Teachings of Christ, is proclaimed by Paramahansa Yogananda. There's a long section in there where he describes at great length how this whole concept that you can convert people to what you want to convert them to and tell them what they should and shouldn't do is just utterly and completely fallacious. You can influence people, but you can only influence them by inspiring them, to open their own consciousness to a new possibility. And mostly the power of that inspiration, I would say entirely, comes from the power of love. That's what the real secret of the masters is just this overwhelming feeling of being safe in the presence of this divine force. And as the relationship with God becomes more intimate through the form of a guru or the presence of Christ, who is the guru, I love the irony of the fact that the fundamentalist Christians rail against all these Eastern concepts like guru, but Christianity is the most guru-oriented religion in the world, which I think is all to its credit. But this is how Swamiji, in this wonderful book, which he deals not only, I shouldn't say not only with Christianity in the sense of just what Jesus taught, but the whole point he's making is that what Jesus taught is in complete conformity with all wisdom of all the ages. And he has to just start at the beginning and explain what it was that Jesus was teaching from completely other contexts and then show that's what he taught. But yes, Jesus is our personal savior. Yogananda is also a personal savior. Krishna, Buddha, all the great masters who had that power. But they become our personal savior not by standing up there and somebody telling you that this is who it is, but when we, in our own hearts, first of all, recognize the fact that I'm not going to make it here all by myself. And you can't even say to someone, some young person said to me recently, he's working out his own personal philosophy of life, and he announced with great joy that, how did he put it? We get to stay here for all eternity trying to figure it out. Whoa, that is not to me a promise. That looks like a real threat, that we have to spend all eternity trying to figure this out. But in his, you know, youthful intellectual zeal and the great power of his own mind, this looks to him like a really wonderful thing. I said, well, let me put it this way. I said, you may, but you don't have to. You know, and that could sort of satisfy us both, and we were comfortable with that. He wants to, I don't. That's as simple as that. I was so interested as I first got onto the spiritual path. And I remember distinctly asking Swamiji this question. I was speaking of my family, and really when I look back on my whole life, I'm using up a lot of really good karma this lifetime. You know, everything has been, I see nothing but blessings in every direction from the moment I was born till the moment I'm standing here right now. I know many people's lives are more, much more externally challenging or even filled with tragedy, and my heart goes out for that. And yet, in a peculiar sort of way, I saw that many people whose lives had already tortured them on levels I couldn't even imagine were still eagerly going after the same things and thinking that this time it was going to work. You know, it's the oddest thing about human nature. And this is a useful characteristic to think about when things are not going well in your life. If we're doing something over and over and it's not working, we think we just need to do more of it. It just doesn't occur to us that maybe the entire concept is wrong. For a long, long time, much longer than when we're talking about reincarnation, how long it takes to really learn even one lesson. But I was born with this intense, just really intense, a thought that above all things in this life, I have to be happy. And I was happy. That was the irony of it. I was just very cheerful by nature, but everything was focused toward whether this will make me happy or not. And it caused me actually a great deal of difficulty growing up because I had all this potential, which is what they call it when you're young, potential. And so I was supposed to do something. But everything I looked at that was possible to do, and this was just my own nature, you know, go to college and learn this, go to professional school and learn that, do this and do this. Somehow, I stood, even as a child, just like right here, and I could see that long road stretching out in front of me. And there was no question in my mind that I could follow the road. So it wasn't anxiety about not being able to get to the end of it. It's just somehow I could feel myself standing at the end of it. you know, I was a great doctor or a research scientist or a politician or any of these things. And I would just stand right there and it wouldn't make me happy. And then it would be like, how could I even put one foot in front of the other? When I look at my whole life before I met Swami Kriyananda, I always feel like I was just standing there. I mean, I did things, but inside I was just standing there because I just didn't know where to put my foot. You know, that it would go somewhere that I wanted it to go. So I said to Swamiji, sir, I've had this intense anxiety about being happy. I said, but I've never even been unhappy. And he said the most obvious thing to me, past lives, Asha. You know, you've lived through many, many experiences. We've all lived through many, many experiences. This is, again, just like if you don't accept the theory, if you think the theory is nuts even, but just see how nicely it works. Because all of a sudden, if I think that the beginning of this life was not the beginning of the book, then of course the character that's formed, that emerges as I become an adult, is going to have all these forces to it. And again, it's not misery. Master writes an autobiography of a yogi so interestingly. That autobiography of a yogi is so astonishingly subtle. You read it over and over again, and then you just come back in our last newsletter. I don't know how many of you are in the habit of reading the newsletter. Since I write it, I like to think that you all read avidly every word of it. But just in case you missed, I was talking a lot about the evolution of animals and how animals relate to human life, and I'm not going to tell you what I said. You're going to have to go read it. But in the course of talking about it, I started thinking about autobiography of a yogi. You know, so many people have pets, and pets are so important to them. And this book that Yogananda wrote, it's not a very long book, but he includes a very interesting story about love for a pet. He talks about a pet deer that he wanted to, that the deer became ill, and then Master prayed and prayed and asked that it be allowed to live. And Master's prayers were, you know, were so powerful, and the energy Master was giving the animal was so powerful that the fawn was holding on to its life. And then when in the night, the soul of that deer appeared to Yogananda and said, I'm trying to go on and you're holding me back. Nothing lasts forever. And so then Master, of course, withdrew his prayer, and almost immediately the animal began to die. At that time, Yogananda was running a school for children. He called all the other children because it was a beloved pet. And then within minutes, the animal passed away and went on. You know, there's just this constantly moving force. But anyway, about the autobiography, when Yogananda talks about reincarnation, he puts it this way. He says, the desire finally not to just keep coming back and coming back and repeating the same story, he said, is not even because it's intensely painful. The phrase he uses is anguishing monotony. Isn't that an extraordinary phrase? The anguishing monotony of it, which is far worse. Tragedy, at least, is interesting. You know, it just really keeps you energized. But the, oh my God, here we go again, is the really scary part of it. I recently, last week, we were asked to do a wedding for friends of ours, and it was a lovely wedding, and they're a very dear couple. And you know, there's something really beautiful about the power of young people. This was a young couple, just making that commitment and all that you see coming in front of them. But the wedding started, as weddings often do. David and I are in the front, and then the older generation, the parents come down and sit down, and the mother comes and sits down, and there's just like, that's the part of the wedding for me that's almost unbearable because of the poignancy of it. You see this elder couple, twice the age or more of the people getting married, and you visualize this little baby that they used to dangle on their shoulder. David and Ginny now have this new little 7-month-old baby, and you know, they're carrying it around and it's throwing up on them and they're staying up late, and just all the things, the endless thing that parents have to do for children, and all the hope, and just, you can't help it. How can you help it but become involved in it? I was sitting at Ananda Village once many years ago, and the building which is now the temple up there used to be our publications building, and it had a balcony out on front, and I don't know how many yards it is, about 300 yards. It's way uphill, and you could sit on this balcony And you could look way down into what is the center of the community. And we used to have our lunches sitting on that balcony, just watching the little play of life down there. And there was a little girl in the community at that time. She's now a grown woman. She was about 6 then. And she was about 50 yards from her father. And her father was on this side, and she was on the other side. And even all that distance, I heard her scream, "Daddy," like this. She raced across, and you know, with that absolute faith children had, just jumped in the air and threw herself at him, and he caught her in his arms like that. And of course, it was so sweet. It was so beautiful. I had a very dear relationship with my father, so fathers and daughters are always particularly touching to me. But I thought, oh my God, both just right in front of me, all the joy and all the potential tragedy of that. Yes, maybe we'll make it through. Maybe this girl will grow up and be real compatible with her father's values. Maybe the mother and father will even stay married to each other the whole time. Maybe she'll get married and, you know, give him grandchildren. Maybe, maybe. But God Almighty, think of all the things that could come in between that. You know, you just pick up the paper anytime, you know, Menlo Park, Atherton, honor student smashes up on the highway. You know, going 100 miles an hour, bang, they're gone. Teenagers, perhaps they were text messaging while they were going down the road. And even if it works, even if it all comes out just so, that's sort of what I'm watching this couple coming down the aisle, the parents coming down the aisle, and you can just feel all that hope. But it's all the more poignant in a strange sort of way, and this is the irony of it. Swamiji was very definite, has been very definite, and I've watched all these things I've learned from him. He said, we learn from having our desires frustrated, but not really. What we learn from having our desires frustrated is that I really want it all the more. Isn't that so? If you don't get it, all you think is, I want it, I want it, I want it. And you just hold on to that thought. That's why we keep reincarnating, because it just doesn't quite work. You know, I got the marriage, but I didn't get the house. I got the house, but I didn't get the kids. I got the kids, but they were the wrong kids. You know? I need a different set of children next time, you know? And you just, it's like it's really close. That's how Master described it, perhaps allegorically. But he said, you know, it's the satanic part of it is not even the tragedy, really. It's the fact that it almost works. And it comes close enough that you think, I'm just a little bit of distance. If you're really far away, you don't even try. But if you're close, you keep trying. It just brings us back again and again. So there's this, so I was saying, so if we don't get what we want, it just tends to go underground in us. We might put on a good front, oh, I didn't really want it anyway. We can even add philosophy over it. It's better to be detached. We can even say things like, this life is not really fulfilling, but we don't really mean it. If we want it and we think it's going to make us happy, it just goes deep into our chakras and we're born the next time with a desire to get it. That's all. Until we have it. Whatever it is. But what happens is, you see, even the most perfect life, if it is externally based, bear in mind, if it is externally based, it just isn't enough. Because, as St. Augustine put it so beautifully, we were made for thee alone, and our hearts are restless until we find our rest in thee. And it's not a curse or some sort of terrible sin that we've committed. It's that our own inner nature is divine. And we can experience that divinity reflected back. Master even said, human love perfectly expressed is almost the same as divine love. It's not that we can't give a great deal to one another. It's not that we can't experience great joy. But the final satisfaction, the peace that passeth all understanding, the love without a second, can only come when we have expanded our awareness to an understanding of who and what we really are, till we have become attuned enough, as Christ put it, to receive him. And nobody's doing anything to us, and it's not a matter of opinion. It's simply the way we're made. And sooner or later, we will, because the human nature will not give up until it gets what it wants. And fortunately, we get to reincarnate as many times as we want to try to get it. And eventually, you get everyone gets everything that they want. This is the divine law. Every desire must be fulfilled. When Master said that to Swami Kriyananda, he said, "Sir, even the desire I had as a child for a little ice cream cone?" Master answered, "Yes, even that." Everything has to be fulfilled sooner or later, because only then will we be able to say, "I drank that cup to the bottom, and I still thirst." And then the question begins to rise in our mind, what will ever satisfy us? And over many, many incarnations, when our own vibration begins to reach a certain point of subtlety, other answers come to us. You know, when I was introduced to the spiritual path, it was just so miraculous to me. I was still quite young, thank God, but I was just seeking and seeking, and the books had always been on the shelf. I was introduced through books. The books had always been on the shelf. Why did I not see them sooner? You know, it's just that extraordinary mystery of our own vibrations reaching a certain point, and then life begins to tell us things that we just didn't know before, or it tells us things that we didn't listen to before. And then we start this long process of trying not to, let me think how to say it. It's not that you repudiate life in an evil way or anything like that. It's that we do exactly what our reading, our scriptural commentary was talking about today. We begin to look at things and we see the truth behind them. We begin to look at human kindness and we see the divine behind it. And the more we begin to see the divine everywhere, the place where divinity shines the most is deep within ourselves. We can't see what we don't ourselves realize. We see, when we are good, we see goodness. When Swami Kriyananda thanked the great saint Ananda Moyi Ma for all that she was doing for him, she answered him so sweetly, "It takes goodness to see goodness." We have to have some sense of God's presence within us, and then we begin to see God's presence all around. That's why it's called self-realization. We begin to know what it is that we have inside of ourselves, and we begin to see that shining everywhere. You know, every morning, every Sunday morning, we come in here and somebody has always done something with the altar, you know, and there's some beautiful shining consciousness. This, you're all looking at it all the time. I have to turn around to see it. But you know, just so much of divine beauty and so much sweetness can be expressed in so many places. I find somehow in the most recent months almost of my life, this extraordinary appreciation for everything. It just seems to be growing. At the same time, also this almost unbearable sadness at how much suffering you see. I can pick up the newspaper and you just read, which we all have read in the last, you know, few weeks. There seems to, summertime, I guess, is when teenagers go out and do foolish things. You know, they're out with their friends in their cars, and there seems to have been a plethora of promising lives just cut off like that. And on one hand, you know, your incarnation ends the moment it's over. We just have a certain number of breaths, and when you finish breathing them, part of the understanding of life that comes with the spiritual path is death is no tragedy. It's not tragic to die. Among other things, friends, we're all doing it. We're doing it all the time. Everybody dies. I know when a group of anti-war activists came to Swamiji. It was when there was that big movement to ban nuclear weapons. I think it was an initiative even on the ballot. I don't even remember. It was a big movement, and it was a well-intentioned movement. But their effort, and they wanted Swamiji to put the weight of Ananda behind their anti-nuclear weapons movement. And they brought, it was really quite impressive, they had these wonderful charts and graphs, and it was all about when the bomb hits in the middle of this population center, how, what's going to happen? And the, you know, the first thing that happens is this vast circle of people are vaporized. I mean, they just are just gone. And then there's a small circle that are burned to death. And then there's a group that are just injured. And then this group out of here dies slowly and horribly of radiation poison. And then the rest of the world starves. I mean, it was really graphic and grim, very, very grim from a certain point of view. As I put this story in the book I wrote about Swami, I put it this way. You know, when you're writing, you have to think very carefully how to say this. fear to motivate people is not a tactic Swami admires. That's how I put it in the book. You know, fear is a powerful motivator, but it's not an admirable tactic. And when Swami was finally able to respond, he said back, he said, I appreciate that you're doing a good thing. He said, but creating this, no, that's not the first thing he said. The first thing he said was, 100 years from now, nobody who's living on the planet's going to be here anyway. Whether we dribble out slowly over the next century or all go to the astral world in one big bang, he said, once we're dead, it won't make a whit of difference. And once they sort of got over that shock, he said, look, I know you're trying to do a good thing, but if you create fear, you're just creating more of the same consciousness you're trying to combat. And that was the whole point. But the other side of that was, you know, nothing we're going to do is, no life is going to last forever. The extent to which we put all our hopes in some kind of a reality that we're going to be able to control, see, that's the folly of it. That's the lack of spiritual understanding. It's not that God doesn't work in cooperation with us. God hears and answers every prayer, but He's working for our ultimate happiness. We're just working to feel good in the moment. And America, of all cultures, is just absolutely dedicated with a passion to feeling good in this moment, not even the next one, but this one. If I'm not feeling good in this moment, then I need to do something right now. But Divine Mother wants us to be blissful for all eternity. You see, these are like we're working at cross purposes with each other. Just like little children want what they want, what they want. They get so excited. As part of this wedding, there was a girl about 3. She was the flower girl. At the wedding rehearsal, I really thought this little child would bust from excitement. Every time she talked about being the flower girl, she would kick her leg like this. You know, she just couldn't contain herself. I'm the flower girl, and she'd swing her leg, and she'd jump like this. She just, you know, she was just going to pieces. Finally, she's the flower girl. It lasted about, 45 seconds. You know, she's all dressed up. She comes down the aisle. She's finished. Oh, you know, it's just like this incredible energy, but it's all focused on this just tiny reality. And, you know, she also just completely meltdown, that's the word you use. She just completely came unhinged because just the sheer panorama of being the flower girl was more than her little system could bear, you know? But the mother has to, like, just slowly by slowly raise this child to have a slightly longer view of things, you know, and just work in a, what you might call even a little more mature. Well, where does that process stop? You think that process stops when we get to be 18 and are old enough to enlist in the army maybe, or vote, or 21 and can drink, or 45 and have children of our own? Where does the process stop? Everything in this world is a symbol. The way the mother and the father raise the child is the way the heavenly parents, so to speak, which is just a way of speaking, are raising us. What's really raising us is the unquenchable inner desire for perfect happiness. And it guides us, whether we personify that, which it is personified through the gurus or the masters, it's always taking care of us. And no matter how excited we are about what we're about to get, and no matter how much we think it's going to make us absolutely happy, that silent, divine witness is always guiding the ship of our consciousness toward its ultimate port of rest in perfect bliss. Whether we struggle against that and constantly throw ourselves in the ground and have temper tantrums over it, or whether we learn slowly by slowly as the child learns who's gifted with wise parents. Well, Father, if you say so. When Jesus, and the balance point of that in the Bible, just before the crucifixion, Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, and you know, this extraordinary, beautifully dramatic scenes, and he prays, Lord, let this cup pass from me. He's speaking of all that is about to come. That was not a personal prayer. That wasn't, oh, I'm scared, I don't want to be crucified. He was saying this cup that I have to drink of sacrifice, because it's the only way that people can understand. Is there any hope that you can raise them up, you know, by their own inspiration? But Jesus prays, let this cup pass from me. Let these people understand. But then he says, but thy will, not mine, be done. You know, we think, well, I'm not in the Garden of Gethsemane, I'm not working with a crucifixion, but that prayer is the perfect prayer, because what it says is, Lord, I open my heart to you without the slightest fear of saying what it is that I actually feel. But once I have shared my heart with you, then I surrender my life into your hands. Lord, I desire this. Lord, I'm lonely. Lord, I'm in pain. How could you have done that to my child? What are you doing to my own body? Where is the port in this world where I will feel comforted? But thy will, not mine, be done. Cultivate that inner relationship with your own understanding of bliss, with your own faith in God, and you will find the anguishing monotony of this world continues on its own level, but we have gone someplace where it can no longer touch us.